Welcome to the Cyber Show. I have taken over the reins whilst Helen and Ed are in Florida, hopefully enjoying themselves. Today we are talking to Rose McDonald on technologically facilitated abuse. So welcome to the Cyber Show, Season 5, Episode 41. Rose, say a little bit about what you do.
Well, thanks for having me, Kate. It's a pleasure to be on the show. And so Rose McDonald's my name, and I work at the coalface of tech-facilitated abuse, very much within the domestic violence community here in Australia. We do a little bit of work doing some training of practitioners in New Zealand and Australia. A lot of the work that we do focuses very much on victim survivors of domestic violence and supporting both the survivors and the organisations who are working with them. Just a bit about my background. So I was 20 years law enforcement here in Australia. I was a detective and then basically went into digital forensics after having a passion for technology. I went back and did some study and moved into that area, and I've been here ever since.
There's been a total lack of awareness, I think, certainly in the UK, and certainly I feel that I could very much do with upping my training, upping my understanding of technologically facilitated abuse. I'm certainly thinking about times when I've been working in mental health services and wanted to support the person in front of me to access domestic violence services, but not actually kept in mind the fact that their phone could have location on. So if I actually walk with them to a domestic violence service, yes, a perpetrator could become aware of that and things like that. So I'm very, very pleased to be talking to you today. Could you maybe describe the lowest end of the work that you've been doing through to the kind of examples of the highest end? I mean, I'm very aware that two women a week are killed in the UK by an intimate partner or former intimate partner. So I know that things can get very dangerous very quickly. Yeah, maybe talk us through some of your day-to-day working life.
Yeah, sure. So look, I guess when we first came into the industry, we found there wasn't a lot of people working in this space in tech facilitated abuse. And those who were probably weren't looking at the areas that we focus on. So typically tech facilitated abuse, when people sort of thought about tech abuse, it was cameras being installed in homes, trackers in cars, and those things still exist now. But what we're finding is there's been a real shift because everybody carries their mobile phone with them. Mobile phones are connected to cloud accounts.
Yeah.
And so we're finding a high rate of tech abuse occurring through those mechanisms. So my day-to-day really starts with working with organisations who may be doing referrals to us, liaising with police about things that we've discovered through our processes. But when we work with victim survivors, what we do is one of two pathways. Our first pathway is a digital safety audit. And that involves meeting with the victim survivor online in an environment like this. And we've developed a methodology that works online so that we don't disadvantage people through location. So we work with the victim survivor. We audit their devices. We also then sign into their online accounts and we share our screen and we audit those online accounts looking for evidence of compromise. And when we find evidence of compromise, we often do more analysis. We explain to the victims what's happening. And then we have a discussion around when is it going to be safe to actually rehabilitate the environment? Because as you could appreciate, we don't want to escalate behaviour. So that is always a really big consideration for us. So if we find evidence of compromise, we have that discussion and then we go about making changes in that environment to make the victim survivor safe. And sometimes that can look like changing settings on their accounts and doing things to the devices and online environment themselves. And sometimes we're required to set a victim survivor up again completely from scratch.
That sounds really important, because what I know about the psychological mechanisms of abusive relationships is that so much involves isolating a victim so that they don't feel able to communicate with friends, family, support, and that social isolation just increases dependence on the potential perpetrator. And so it seems so important to know whether the devices we are using are safe or whether they've been compromised.
And it's probably important for your listeners to appreciate that most of the time when we look at devices, people are often scared about spyware, but it actually forms a small part of what we find when we're looking at compromised devices. Most of the time, they're legitimate applications and services that perpetrators have misconfigured so that they can then take advantage of the content on those devices, such as tracking and so forth. But just to answer your question on the second pathway we offer is more of a digital forensic pathway, and that involves us taking possession of various devices, whether that's computers or mobile phones or other devices, and using quite sophisticated software and hardware to perform forensic extraction and then further analysis. Everything that we do is really focused on managing the situation through the lens of preservation.
Yeah.
It's really important to do that, because so many victim survivors seek support from people who mean well, and they may be IT providers, they might be your local mobile phone repair shop, but commonly what happens in that space is phones get factory reset, applications are deleted, and it's a real missed opportunity to first of all see, well, how's the compromise occurring, and secondly, you know, not having the opportunity to preserve that evidence in the process.
What I'm thinking is that in my work in the mental health field, often people who experience psychosis or have experienced extreme trauma won't have a sense of what is real, what is truthful, what is an actual threat, and what might be feelings, fantasies, paranoia. And I guess that you talking about evidence preservation is really, really important, because actually that person who may well have been an actual victim of crime but also be feeling very paranoid and very intruded upon, if actually these well-meaning people have come in and wiped evidence that you need to establish the truth, maybe go through the courts as part of evidence in a criminal investigation, if that's been wiped, then that person has never actually kind of worked out, well, what was truth and fact, and what was feelings and legitimate feelings of paranoia and fear. So I guess don't just wipe devices and give it to people who aren't experts in your field.
It's really important that when we work with victim survivors who have lost opportunities to proceed to make a report to police or get some advice from a legal advocate because the evidence is no longer there, it's really harmful. So everything that we do, all the training that we do with domestic and family violence practitioners and other health professionals, always encourages people to look at everything they do through that lens of preservation. And that's not to say that at some point you don't take remedial action, but you want to preserve things first. And, you know, you touch on a really good point with people who might be suffering some mental health issues. People with mental health issues can also be victim survivors of tech abuse and not mutually exclusive. But sometimes when we manage clients who might have some mental health issues, we also then need to ensure that our communication with those people isn't going to escalate their fears or paranoias around what might be happening. So that can sometimes be a tricky conversation for us. So we work very closely with the health practitioners to ensure that people have that rounded support.
That sounds really important. Say a little bit more about what tech-facilitated abuse is.
Tech-facilitated abuse is really, it is using technology to cause harm or abuse somebody. That is at its base level. But what does that look like? It could look like monitoring a person's communications and online activities. It could include sending abusive text messages and making abusive phone calls. It could be using a tracking device, sharing intimate or personal photographs of a person without their consent. And often, sadly, it's used to coercively control, intimidate, bully, harass, essentially causing people fear or making them feel scared or unsafe.
That's a really concise, helpful definition. Can you say a little bit more about the prevalence of tech-facilitated abuse?
Yeah, look, I think that the prevalence is quite frightening when you look at it. So I can speak from an Australian's perspective. The research here shows that one in two Australians are likely to be victims of tech-facilitated abuse within their lifetime. One in four a perpetrator. And there was some research done here which looked at about 4,500 adults between the ages of 18 and 25. And they found that over 63% of them had experienced tech-facilitated abuse. And then when we look at DV practitioners, those who are engaging in conversations about tech-facilitated abuse with their clients, we found that over 90% of them have had clients who are experiencing tech abuse. So the prevalence is quite concerning, and I don't think that there's much difference globally in terms of that experience. The other thing that we do know is that there's not a lot of research in this space, and there's two universities here that have partnered with some universities internationally, and I believe one in London. The great news is that they're really going to do some international research around this, and so hopefully we'll get more and more evidence-based solutions as we move forward.
It sounds common and everyday. Say more about the sort of signs of tech abuse that someone might show, might bring to a practitioner, might talk to friends. So what sort of signs should both be looking out for?
It's a really good question, because I think that there's two components to when you consider whether tech abuse is involved or not. And one is the experience, and then can the client give an example of their concern? Because there's a lot of behaviour of devices that seem unusual or perhaps not familiar to people. Mm. And when people are in a heightened state of concern and they see their device behave in a certain way, that can trigger a response that might actually just be normal device behaviour. But if people are finding that things like they've got a pretty new phone, not an old phone where you would expect the battery to be draining quickly, if that's occurring, that can be a sign of particular applications using up a lot of resources on the device. If the perpetrator of violence is showing up at locations that they really shouldn't know that you're going to be there, and it's more than coincidence, they suddenly appear at a location. If they know information about you that you haven't shared, or they might actually know something about you that you've only shared in a particular environment they shouldn't have access to. Some of those things are signs that, you know, you might want to start looking into devices in your online environment a little bit more. We also developed a risk assessment that we disseminated to practitioners, and I'd be happy to share that with you if your viewers wanted to have a look at that. There's an abridged version on our website, 20 questions, and it gives people a bit of an indication as to whether or not there might be a problem.
That sounds really, really useful. In the UK, I'm not sure whether there's any tools like that, but I'm imagining that actually it would be so useful. I have sat in what has known in the UK as MARIC meetings, multi-agency risk assessment council or something like that. I'm getting alphabet soup in my mind. Basically, the idea is that all the people, such as police, health, education, social care, discuss the most high-risk families, high-risk incidents, and we use a risk assessment tool called a CADA-DASH, which is about 24 questions establishing at what level of risk this possible victim is at. And so actually to incorporate a tool that really identifies tech-facilitated abuse alongside existing tools like that could really help. I suspect that internationally and probably in the UK especially, agencies haven't really woken up to the prevalence of tech-facilitated abuse and integrated tools into mainstream practice.
It's really important. In our experience in Australia, we have a very similar system in Australia called the MORM here. One of the things, our experience working in this field is exactly that. Risk assessments in relation to tech abuse don't seem to be embedded in systems. Yeah. And unless they are, and unless they're, the way that we designed our risk assessment was assuming that a person, so a practitioner, doesn't have any tech knowledge at all and that they don't need the tech knowledge, because really it's just about opening up a conversation, because people will express their concerns and they will tell their practitioner about the things that they're experiencing. And if you have a reference to be able to sort of frame that for you, then I think that's really important. But you're absolutely right. These types of risk assessments really need to be embedded in mandatory processes, because excluding them, when you look at the statistics of the prevalence, if you're not finding tech abuse, you're not sort of looking for it.
Absolutely. The sort of common questions that would be incorporated in the standard tool, the CADA-RIC assessment used in the UK, things like has the person ever threatened suicide? It would be about someone sending messages kind of with vague insinuations of, if you don't do this, then I will harm myself, harm you, harm the pet, harm children. And it's using that technology to just further escalate the coercive controlling behaviour. It's kind of amplifying it.
Well, it's also can be really dangerous too. We had a situation here in Australia, and fortunately this woman is okay, but she'd seen three particular tech providers. They had all cleared her phone, told her it was safe. On the basis of that, she went to a new home, kept her location very closed, only a couple of people and a real estate agent, woke up her first morning, opened her blinds, and the perpetrator was standing opposite her new home, staring at her through the window. And you could imagine how she felt at that moment. And when we looked at her environment, we found very quickly that it was compromised. And, you know, without, in the absence of doing a risk assessment, those things were missed. And so it just highlights the importance, because fortunately this woman wasn't assaulted and no physical harm came to her. But, of course, there was a lot of psychological harm that resulted from that experience.
And that psychological harm, I guess, can be really minimised. I wonder whether in the UK there's a culture of, well, if there's not physical harm going on, then police aren't interested and no crime has been committed. But actually that psychological harm of intimidation, of using that technology to find out where someone is, just that perpetrator's presence is enough to do psychological harm there.
Well, if we suggested to your viewers that they turn their phones off now and put them all in the drawer for the next 4 hours, people would have a reaction to that. There'd be a whole variety of reactions. It'd be, no, I can't because I'm at work and I need to check emails and receive calls, or I need to be available if my children get sick at school, or just, you know, I need access to my device.
Yeah.
But imagine being isolated from the digital world, and then when you're trying to engage with it, having the fear that somebody might be monitoring everything that you're doing. So it's really pervasive, and I don't think that elements of society really appreciate yet the harm that it causes. Working with victim survivors, as you do, Kate, I'm sure that you see it, that many of the survivors say to us, this is even worse because I just feel like I'm violated all the time. And it's something that I think that probably is open for broader discussion. in terms of, you know, health professionals and police and other people working in the field. I think it's sort of a topic that absolutely should be on the table.
From my point of view in attachment theory, typically when people are under stress or in danger, healthy response is that we seek out safe other people who are going to help us. Hopefully how we raise our children to be, that if they're distressed, they come to mummy or granny or a safe person that they know is going to be taking care of them, looking after them. When we are ill, we want that extra bit of taking care of, or we want to know that actually we can reach safe others. But if our communication is all digital and through these devices, then it erodes our sense of trust and our usual help-seeking behaviour, and the thing that can actually get us out of a tricky situation or make us feel grounded and safe and secure again, which is why it's such a pernicious form of abuse.
Oh, absolutely. I think, as we said, you know, the harm is significant. And I think that we're probably a little bit behind in terms of understanding some of that, but we're getting there. I think, you know, the UK has got coercive control laws. Australia are now bringing those in different states. And we're yet to see, I think, some matters go through the court to see how that plays out yet. But I think it's going to be an interesting space. And there's a lot of sort of shift, you know, around people's experience of technology and so forth. And over time, hopefully people's digital literacy and confidence will improve. All of those things go together towards sort of making a safer society, I think.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
Welcome to our workplace cybersecurity training. Training with Boudica is a different experience. We offer very high academic quality, accessibility, flexible study, and high outcome impact. Our course is unique and specially built by an expert team of university professors to deliver the same standard of teaching you'd find at a top university, but condensed and tailored for beginners. If you're interested and want us to be part of your journey to better company cybersecurity, contact us at Boudica. We'd love to hear from you. Connect by following the links or visit our website, boudicasecurity.com, for more details.
Tell me more about the common methodologies that are used by perpetrators.
What we often find, or if for those listeners that may not be aware, so if you've got your mobile phone, a smartphone, you'll typically have an Android phone or you'll have an iPhone. An iPhone will be connected to an iCloud account. That phone might also be connected to a Google account if you've got a Gmail and you've set your phone up using Gmail. If you've got an Android phone, your Android phone will be connected to a Google account and whatever other accounts that you've might have established on that phone. And that relationship is really important, because sometimes people will think that tech abuse doesn't occur unless somebody has physical possession of somebody's mobile phone and they can install a spyware app on it. But that's not really true. It's true in the context that if you're going to install something on a device, you typically need possession of the device. But the reason I talk about the relationship between the device and the cloud environment is because most people's mobile phones back up to one of those online environments. And so if a perpetrator of violence gets access to the cloud account and the phone is backing up to the cloud account, then they have opportunities to read emails, look at location data, access documents, photographs, and other sort of personal information that somebody may, you know, want to keep that personal and private.
Yeah.
Certainly not have their perpetrator having access to it. It could be legal communications. It could be all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the time when we do this work, it's really important for us to have a look at those online environments to establish, have they been compromised. So that's one thing that we focus on quite a lot. And then, of course, the second component is the device. And I've mentioned spyware, but I've also said that it's not a huge amount of the work that we do. We run a spyware malware lab, and it's the only one in Australia. So we actually purchase this stuff. We do a thing called parameterization, so we understand how it works, so we know what to look for. But even doing that work, we probably only find it about 10% of the time. So most of the time when devices themselves are compromised, it'll be things like typical family sharing type of setups where the perpetrators actually connected themselves to either a children's device or their partner's device. And then they're accessing, you know, location and so forth through that mechanism. It could be particular applications that are sharing out information with a perpetrator. So we had a victim survivor once who had her notes application where she kept a lot of information about meetings with her domestic violence practitioner, her legal, legal notes and so forth. And we found that actual notes application was being shared out to an account that the perpetrator had access to. So what we tend to find is applications that are misconfigured so that they share to another account. We also sometimes find things like if somebody's got a smartwatch and they've got an account with a smartwatch, if the perpetrator has infiltrated that account, again, they can get information about location and so forth. So a lot of what we find is around that misconfiguration of applications and services and then sitting in online environments.
I guess that has got massive implications for safety planning and things like that. We know that there are often three times when a woman is most at risk from a perpetrator of domestic violence: when the violence is escalating, when someone becomes pregnant, and when they are planning to leave. And I guess all of those instances might have some digital footprint somewhere that a perpetrator could get access to. So be forewarned is forearmed. And so actually it makes things like safety planning really, really difficult.
Feel free, go on our website and do the risk assessment, or find, you know, in the UK you might have some risk assessment tools that you can access. But do a risk assessment and then sort of just consider that in the context of your daily life. So it's not just about what's happening with the device, it's also those other behavioural characteristics that we touched on earlier, such as the perpetrator turning up to events that he should not have known that you were attending. Those types of behavioural characteristics in combination with things that might be happening with the device, other things that people need to look for.
That's really helpful. And I guess that for me, what's coming into my mind is culture around use of digital technology. And many well-meaning parents do things like give their children a smartphone that has got location on and everything. And the intention might actually be good, but does that create a culture where people just assume that it's okay for others to know where they are and what they're doing all the time? And so maybe education needs to start quite young.
That's a really interesting topic, because obviously parents want to keep their children safe and know where they are and be able to be them for them when their children need assistance. But it's also a real interesting cultural sort of discussion, I think, about whether placing parental applications, which are essentially they act like spyware, on a child's device, and what are the privacy issues around that for the child? I guess that's a whole other topic. But certainly I think that it's important for people to also be aware that perpetrators don't necessarily just target the victim survivors' devices and accounts, but sometimes they will gift a child iPad or another type of device that they set up, and it may be set up with family sharing or other sort of applications that allow the monitoring of the victim survivor through the child. There's another game that we put an alert out on recently, perfectly legitimate game called Roblox, but it has the capacity to chat with a child and engage and have audio discussions with other people. And we've had instances where perpetrators have a court order to say they can't have contact with that child, but then subsequently we've found that they've had accounts chatting to the child within those types of games applications. And that's not to say anything negative about that particular game. It's just an example of what can occur.
What is tragic in these situations is that there might be a benign wish of parents who are separating to remain in contact with the children, but actually how easy when conflict arises for that to kind of tip into tech-facilitated abuse. And so I guess it being really important, what are the arrangements around child contact? What are the boundaries there?
And that can be really difficult because sometimes the courts enforce certain things, like you have to share a phone number, you have to share certain information so that you can communicate about the children through the separation. But that can also be a give another level of complexity if tech abuse is involved and you're trying to actually isolate yourself. So that's just a whole complex sort of issues that I guess the courts need to work through.
You have talked about the importance of preserving evidence and not doing something that could escalate behaviour. So could you say a little bit more about what to do if you're concerned and how you can get help?
Yeah, look, I think if you are concerned about tech abuse or violence or anything like that, I think that there's a few things that you can do. If your safety is at risk, it's always important that you reach out to police. I think that if you are immediately concerned for your welfare, I think that that's police is your first port of call. There's also domestic violence agencies. You know, I'm sure that you have many across the UK that people can reach out to, a health provider such as a doctor or a counsellor or a trusted friend or family member. I think the important thing is that the first thing to do is to speak to somebody that you trust and then look for services that might have some expertise or professionalism around either tech abuse or DV, and then seek those out. You probably have a phone number that people can call, like a 1-800-RESPECT or something like that in UK, which would be the equivalent to what's here in Australia. And there may also be a national tech DV centre in the UK. I'm not sure. There's one here where people can call and get some advice. But I certainly think the first thing to do is to make sure that you deal with safety first, always, and then consider those people that might have some expertise around the problem that you're having. And in relation to tech abuse, the sorts of things to ask an IT provider is, have you done this sort of work before? What actions do you take? How do you preserve evidence? What do you do if you find compromise? What's your experience? And do you actually write a report of the actions that you've taken? They're the sorts of questions that I think I would be asking a provider before you engage them. You want to know their qualifications, experience in tech abuse, whether they write reports. Can they facilitate contact with police or another service provider? Will they be able to explain what they've found to police or a legal advocate? And are they able to give evidence in court? And some people will be able to do some of those things or not all of those things, but the critical thing really is that they preserve the evidence and they do everything through that lens of preservation and safety.
From a psychological point of view, just the importance of reaching out can be hugely significant. Of just having a conversation that goes along the lines of, I've got these fears, I've got these worries, I think I'm going a bit crazy. And to have the person listening to that saying, you're not going crazy, you're not going mad, actually what's happening isn't okay. it is real in terms of how you're feeling, and this is the reality in terms of what's going on with your technology, it's really important to get that grasp of what's going on. And so that actually when people feel unsafe, they don't just assume that, well, this is just a normal part of relationships. It's what happens these days. That actually that there's a sense of people get the message that it's not okay, and no, it's not normal for someone to want to monitor your every moment that you're having.
Absolutely, and I think you touched on it before when you spoke about, you know, creating this culture of getting used to being monitored. And I read an article recently from one of the providers who provide monitoring type services within their application. And the essence of that article was that most people these days feel that it's a deal breaker if they're in a relationship and the person rejects sharing location and being monitored. And that horrifies me. When you look at the prevalence of tech abuse, if we're going to create this culture where people are so used to being monitored, then what do we do when things go bad? It's frightening to me. But I think that getting back to your reaching out, it's really important that people have a conversation, and it needs to be a person that they trust and a person who will listen to them and can facilitate some of that support.
Absolutely. I mean, it just reminds me of when I've been kind of people watching. I've gone to meet my husband somewhere. I knew, well, he says he's going to be here at this time, just meeting out for drinks after work. I knew that some of his colleagues were going to be with him. We just had a trusting relationship. So we didn't need any tech monitoring or anything like that. And so I just rocked up, ordered a glass of wine, and people said, oh, last time we saw your husband, he was carrying a baseball. He'll be about 5 minutes. And I go, I know, I trust him. He'll be here in 5 minutes. That's no problem. But actually, this would have been maybe about 2010. A number of his colleagues all got out their smartphones and were also waiting for their partners to arrive, but could see their partner's location. And things like that, it did strike me as very odd and not something that I would permit for me.
You know, it's not just the location stuff, it's sharing passwords, it's giving access to various accounts. And you know, whilst people might do that, you know, from time to time in a relationship, I think it's important that once that relationship finishes or things start to go, you know, in a direction that feels unsafe, that people change the passwords to their accounts and take some of those security steps, just like they might take other safety steps around preparing to leave a relationship or otherwise just trying to contain a situation within a relationship as they're reaching out for some advice and support.
Could you tell me something about smart devices in the home? Because I guess what alarms me is the idea that someone doing the safety planning and someone really wanted to put in a robust safety plan for when they leave, if their home is not safe and their devices aren't safe and their online accounts aren't safe, how to navigate that? Can you say a little bit more about smart devices in the home?
Yeah, sure. Look, it's one of those things that, you know, people are becoming more and more aware of. We've had a couple of instances. One recently comes to mind where a smart vacuum cleaner was following a victim survivor around the house, and it was attached to an application with an audio function. So it was actually recording as it was following the victim survivor. So I think that in relation to smart devices in the home, a number of these do have the ability to record, you know, conversation and so forth. But again, all of these devices are linked to an application that you can access online. And so if somebody's not present in the house, the only way they can access that information is by having access to the online account to which that device is connected. Mm. So checking those accounts and making sure that you're the only person listed in those accounts is a good thing to do if you're separated and you're no longer living together. But I also think that there's a consideration for manufacturers here as well, where have a light that is activated on top of a device if an audio recording is being activated. Simple things like that, so that it becomes obvious to people when some of these features are working. Yes, look, I think that we need to be more and more conscious of smart devices, but I think that the simple solution to that is to understand that smart devices are linked to an account, and the compromise or the concern would be within that account most of the time. And I'm not talking about if somebody comes into somebody's home and they actually plant a device or camera or something in the home separate to that. But if you're actually looking at devices themselves, they typically are connected to an online account, and that's usually where breaches are most likely to occur.
A lot of rows that my patients are reporting, things like ring doorbells, a perpetrator might say, did that parcel arrive at that time? And they say, oh, yeah, it was around about 10:30. Well, I know that it was 11 o'clock because I saw on the ring doorbell that it was 11. So why are you lying to me? I mean, it just, the amount of information seems really quite maddening, and someone who has got the propensity for abusing their partner will use the technology that's available to them.
Absolutely, and again, you know, a doorbell's linked to an account, and so if you've got access to that account, then you get access to the information. So it's, yeah, look, it's you're right. It can be quite overwhelming because we are just so embedded with devices and online environments and accounts, and we have multiple passwords, and we have, you know, it can be quite overwhelming for people. And also, you know, we have our home internet, and you know, that if the perpetrator also knows, if you're not living together but you haven't changed the password, and they know the password to the home Wi-Fi, then they can join the home Wi-Fi as well if they're close enough to the home. So there's just so many different avenues, I suppose, that perpetrators can take advantage of. And so I guess that's part of my role, is to systematically go through all those options and address them as we find them.
Before we wrap up and say our goodbyes for now, could you just tell us a little bit more about your goods and services and how they address the points we've been talking about today?
Our website is natson.io, and we offer those services, the digital safety audits, which are online. We've had a couple of people reach out from the UK before. We've had a couple of people from America. We conduct those online, so we can support people that way. We also build products. So we built a product called ChainFS, which is designed to keep victim survivors of domestic violence safe, insofar as part of their safety planning. It's a cloud environment where they can store critical and personal documents and information and evidence in a form that is immutable, which means that even if a perpetrator of violence got access to the account, they can't read the contents of the files, they can't share a file, they can't download a file, they can't modify a file, and they can't delete the file. So that's something else that we provide. And if anybody's interested in, you know, further information about that, then they're welcome to reach out to me.
It can get really dark. I think if Ed was here, he might be saying that the Doom monitor is a little bit high. So maybe we could just lighten the mood.
It can be quite heavy, can't it? But I think that, you know, you have to keep things in perspective. Generally speaking, I deal with all of this stuff. I run, I go to the gym and do a bit of meditation and have a good circle of friends and a close family. So you just got to try to keep things in perspective and know that there's help out there. And I think probably the other thing, and this is a little heavy, but I think that, you know, if you are somebody who is tempted to engage in tech abuse for whatever reason. I think I heard something recently that I thought was really pivotal, and that was, it doesn't matter what happened to you in your childhood or when you were a young adult, a young teenager, that's never your fault, but your healing is your responsibility. And I think that was a really good way of saying that accountability of your own actions, get some help, and yeah, hopefully we can work toward living in a more peaceful world.
That's, I think, what most of us really, really want. Self-care, exercise, friends, family. Really important to just restore one's faith in humanity. Well, listen, enjoy your TV and your wine and your meal. And it's really good to talk to you. I'm glad that there are people out there like you, Rose. And thank you for being on The Cyber Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.